Okay, so we've just started a new series looking at the book of Joshua. Di kicked things off last week. She gave us an overview of the whole series. And so in the weeks to come, we'll be looking at the life of Joshua as an invitation to an adventure. But when Di asked me to be a part of this series, I just knew that I had to address the elephant in the room. This particular phrase is such an expressive one, and it's certainly great fodder for cartoons like this one. Got this depressed-looking elephant talking to his therapist, saying, "Sometimes, even if I stand in the middle of the room, no one acknowledges me." Or this far-side one that takes the opposite approach. "Now calm down, Barbara. We haven't looked everywhere yet, and an elephant can't hide forever." Everyone see it up in the back corner there? Or this one, non sequitur. The guy saying, "Oh, I thought you were just speaking metaphorically." Even Banksy has got into this. For his first US exhibition back in 2006, Banksy painted a full-sized elephant to match the wallpaper of a room hung with his altered artworks. And then people coming to the exhibition, as they filed through, they had to actually peer past the elephant in order to see the artworks. Look, I'm sure everyone knows what the phrase means. The elephant in the room is the enormous issue or problem that no one wants to discuss. Because it's just too hard, perhaps. But by ignoring it, it actually takes a lot of effort. That means that everyone has to agree to just to ignore it in an act of corporate selective blindness, no matter what damage is done in the process. But if true progress is to be made, someone has to draw everyone's attention back to the issue and address it head on. So if there is an elephant in the room, we really need to face it. Well, what has this got to do with the book of Joshua? Well, there's a seriously major issue in the book of Joshua. And if we don't face it squarely, head on, we run the risk of significantly distorting our understanding of the nature of God. What issue am I referring to? I'm talking about divinely sponsored genocide. So, as the nation of Israel takes over the land of Canaan, they are told by God to destroy every living thing, every man, woman, and child, and all of their livestock. The opening battle, the famous fall of Jericho, ends with the death of every man, woman, and child, everyone living in the city, with the only exception being Rahab and her family because of what she did to protect the Israelite spies. Now, there are those that would say that God did not command the genocide, but it really is hard to avoid this conclusion when you read the book itself. So we're going to look at Joshua 10. I'm reading from verse 28. "That day, Joshua took Makkedah. He put the city and its king to the sword and totally destroyed everyone in it." And just to make sure we get the message, he left no survivors. "And he did to the king of Makkedah as he had done to the king of Jericho. Then Joshua and all Israel with him moved on from Makkedah to Libnah and attacked it. The Lord also gave that city and its king into Israel's hands. The city and everyone in it Joshua put to the sword. He left no survivors there. And he did to its king as he had done to the king of Jericho." I'm going to skip a bit. But if you have the time and the stomach for it, you can read for yourself what Joshua did to the people of Lachish, Eglon, Hebron, and Debir. And then at the end of the chapter, we get a summary. So verse 40. "So Joshua subdued the whole region, including the hill country, the Negev, the western foothills, and the mountain slopes, together with all their kings. He left no survivors. He totally destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. Joshua subdued them from Kadesh Barnea to Gaza and from the whole region of Goshen to Gibeon. All these kings and their lands Joshua conquered in one campaign because the Lord, the God of Israel, fought for Israel." Look, I don't find this very pleasant to read, because we are talking about the slaughter of women and children here. If it was just the fighting men, it might be slightly more palatable, but everyone? And note what the text says. Just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. And then Joshua is successful in these battles because the Lord, the God of Israel, fought for Israel. What are we to make of this? How do we explain what looks like very much like God-ordained genocide? So, turn to the person or people next to you and for a couple of minutes, talk about your response to that. Go. All right, we'll get a chance to do some more chatting later, I hope. But this is the elephant in the room. When we look at the book of Joshua, we have to reckon with the fact that a large part of the book of Joshua is all about the slaughtering of people as Israel moves into the land. Well, how do we explain the genocide? Or even, you know, explain it away completely? Well, there are a couple of ways of dealing with this particular problem. The first explanation is that the Canaanites were terribly evil and were therefore deserving of death. And we can certainly find this line of thought in the Old Testament itself. There are a number of places where the evil of the Canaanites is mentioned as the reason for God's command to Joshua to devote them to the Lord, which is the spiritual way of describing total annihilation. And this motif starts off really early as well. We get it right after the flood story in the opening chapters of Genesis. If you recall, it's a bit of a weird passage, but Noah gets drunk and sleeps in the nude, and then his son, Ham, walks in on Noah. He goes out and seems to laugh about it. His two brothers are all, oh no, that's terrible. They back in with a cloak so that they can't see their father's nakedness and cover him up. And then when Noah wakes up, he curses that first son, that son. But check out the text. Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers. He also said, praise be to the Lord, the God of Shem, may Canaan be the slave of Shem. May God extend Japheth's territory. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem. And may Canaan be the slave of Japheth. So even though Ham did the bad thing, it's Ham's son, Canaan, who's going to cop it. So here we have what's known as a forecho in the text, a forecho of what's to come. Then when we get to Abraham, we get another verse. Yep, that's the one. It's a bit of a cryptic passage. So God says that the possession of the land by Abraham's ancestors has to wait 400 years, for the sin of the Amorites, which refers to the Canaanites, has not yet reached its full measure. So they're sort of evil, but they haven't got evil enough yet. And then when we get to Deuteronomy, as the Israelites are approaching the land of Canaan, there are some verses very much along this idea. So, after the Lord your God has driven them out before you, do not say to yourself, the Lord has brought me here to take possession of the land because of my righteousness. No, it is on account of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is going to drive them out before you. It is not because of your righteousness or your integrity that you are going in to take possession of their land, but on account of the wickedness of these nations, the Lord your God will drive them out before you to accomplish what he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All right. Is that it? Is that all that we get? Interestingly, in Deuteronomy 7, and then later in Deuteronomy 20, which I'll put up in a sec, we actually find that the problem is not that the Canaanites were so terribly evil. The problem is that any intermingling with the Canaanites runs the risk of the Israelites turning away from following God to serve other gods. So there in verse 4. That's the real reason. The problem is not the Canaanites' great sin. The problem is how weak the Israelites are. And then, here's 20. According to these texts, God wants the inhabitants of Canaan, including women and children, wiped out so that there is no chance God's people will be led astray. A modern day equivalent to this is punishing women for not dressing modestly when the real problem is men's lust. So, according to the Pentateuch, while the extreme sin of the Canaanites is a factor, even the Bible itself doesn't fully subscribe to this explanation. So, that's the first way of dealing with the elephant in the room. Now, the second way of doing it relates to the concept of progressive revelation. A bit complicated, so let's just talk about what that means, and then we'll see how that applies to the problem. The idea of progressive revelation is that God, in his grace, does not try and push his people too far or too quickly. He meets them where they are, within their cultural environment and their worldview. But he's pointing them in the right direction. So in the Old Testament, God does in fact appear to be somewhat similar to the gods of the other nations round about, but still different enough so that Israel stands out. Then as time goes by, God can direct his people a little further towards the ideal. Actually, I think there is something to this idea of progressive revelation, and we can definitely see it in the Old Testament. So let's take the first concept, that God meets people within their cultural environment, but gently nudges them in the right direction. When we read through the laws in the Pentateuch, a lot of it appears to be very harsh to our modern ears. But to someone living at that time, these laws are actually very progressive. Take the issue of rape. Wow, I hear you say, genocide and rape in the same sermon, way to lift people up. Anyway, in the nations of the ancient Near East, if a woman was raped, a common law of the time basically condemned her to death. Easy, simple, dealt with, done. But in Israel, the law, far from condemning her to death, actually provided for her ongoing support. After all, if you've got a woman who's been raped, who's going to want to marry her, okay? So the easiest thing to do, just kill her, all right? Problem solved. But the law doesn't say that. The law in the Pentateuch. She's given the choice to marry her rapist. Well, at least her father's given the choice. And if this option was taken up, the law further states that her new husband is never allowed to divorce her for any reason. And that means she is set up for life, you know, she is looked after for life. And any child, particularly son, born of the rape would now be a legitimate heir and so would inherit the property from the father. So while this law sounds horrible to us, it's actually a huge improvement compared with the common approach of the time. Another example of this. Everyone's familiar with the law of retribution. It's an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Well, in this sort of in this law, God is actually trying to limit retributive justice. So, if someone pokes out your eye, then the most you can do in response is to poke out one of their eyes, and only one. Don't go for two, or lop off an arm or a leg while you're at it. Because then the other person is going to respond with even more violence. And before you know it, one of you is going to be dead. So on the whole, we know this. More violence doesn't deal with the problem of violence. It just keeps the whole cycle of violence going. But the eye for an eye law was trying to stop that. It was saying, okay, yes, you've been harmed. There is the limit. That is the extent And so this law is an improvement on the usual response. It's progressive. It points the way towards greater levels of justice and mercy. All right, what is very interesting is that the Old Testament covers a considerable period of time in terms of how it was when it was written. And so the second part of the concept of progressive revelation is that with a number of topics in the Old Testament, we can see changes in the way people think. So, for example, in 2 Samuel 24:1, we read this. Again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, "Go and take a census of Israel and Judah." Now, when this story is retold in 1 Chronicles 21:1, this becomes Satan rose up against Israel and incited David to take a census of Israel. So we see that what was earlier ascribed to God is now ascribed to Satan. There's been a development in the understanding of evil in the intervening time. An even better example. In the Pentateuch, God speaks of punishment being meted out on the sons and daughters of the sinner for generations. When we get to the later Old Testament prophets, though, we find that only the sinner should be punished, not the sons and daughters. And the prophet makes his point with this brilliant little illustration, the image of the parents eating the sour grapes, but the teeth of the children being set on edge. Okay? Very cool illustration. So there's been a development, a clearer understanding as the time has progressed. So that's the concept of progressive revelation. Well, how does this help us with the issue of genocide in Joshua? Well, it's a two-stage argument. Firstly, you would say, the conquest of Canaan is said to only be a momentary necessity in history. It was a particular action for a particular time and place and for a specific God-ordained reason. And it's not repeated. Israel knew they had a role to play in bringing judgment on Canaan. After that, their calling for holy war was complete. That's the sort of the first part of it. But unfortunately, that isn't quite accurate. A little later in Israel's history, King Saul is again tasked to enact holy war. That is, he's asked to totally destroy an entire people group, men, women, children, livestock. And he's given a theological reason for that war as well. And then later still, of course, we know that King David, while he is not explicitly asked to enact holy war, he certainly expands the boundaries of the land. And then, when we look at what Joshua actually does during the conquest of the land, like what we saw in chapter 10, we see that the Israelites don't exactly go about their holy war in a carefully moderated way. I could have read through the first half of Joshua chapter 10, but it's brutal, resulting in 5 defeated kings being killed and their bodies hung on trees. And the same goes for other things that the Israelites did during this time, like dividing the Moabite virgin women and girls, that was the spoils of war among the Israelites, which we read about in Numbers 31. All right, be all that as it may, the second stage of this argument is that we need to view all this violence through the lens of the New Testament. Jesus is the culmination of God's unfolding revelation, and Jesus clearly taught love of enemies and turning the other cheek. So we know now that God's kingdom cannot be achieved through violence, but we're still left with questions. Why the change of heart? Why did God command genocide then, but is all about love and grace later? And why is taking the land such a major priority in the Old Testament, but keeping the land is such a low priority in the New Testament? And in fact, if we think about how Jesus came to Israel, he came as Messiah, but he didn't come as a militaristic Messiah. But if he had, that would have fitted right in with the Old Testament, that the whole concept of holy war. But Jesus made it very clear that that type of Messiah was wrong, satanic even. So in the end, I think this particular method leaves us with more questions than answers. All right, so one of those two approaches might work for you, but is there a third option? I think there is. But it involves a bit of a back step to look at the nature of the Bible itself. When it comes to the interpretation of the Bible, we all come with certain presuppositions. These are things that we believe, either consciously or even sometimes unconsciously, about how the Bible came to be. And the most important presupposition has to do with who we think was responsible for the Bible. Was it God? Or was it humans? Or was it somehow both at the same time? Well, some people would argue that the Bible is 100% the work of God and 0% the work of humans. This is essentially the dictation model. Now, some sections of the Bible do sound like they were dictated. The bits where it says, "And God said..." dot, dot, dot. The Ten Commandments were dictated to Moses. But on the whole, interestingly, evangelical scholars would not say that the Bible was woodenly dictated by God. In fact, this is what Muslims believe about the Quran, that Allah dictated the text to Muhammad and he just wrote it all down. But that's not what we would say God did with the Bible. Okay, at the other extreme, some people, but not many Christians, would argue that the Bible is 0% the work of God and 100% the work of humans. But I think you will all agree that that is very definitely not the case. We believe that the Bible was divinely inspired, that God was definitely at work. And then there are those who might think that some of the Bible is divinely inspired, but other parts of it are just the work of humans, either 50-50 or 60-40 or some other pair of numbers adding up to 100. But this is also problematic, because does this mean we should only obey the divinely inspired bits and ignore the rest? And then how would you know which bits were which? Again, it looks like we're out of options. But there is a fourth way. And we can see this if we look at the incarnation. The incarnation is that fancy theological word for the fact that Jesus was born as a human. But what makes the incarnation so interesting is the fact that Jesus is 100% divine and 100% human at the same time. And this really is a paradox. Theologians tie themselves up in knots trying to get their heads around it. And so it turns out that we really just have to accept that this is true. 100% human, 100% divine at the same time. So getting back to the nature of the Bible and using the incarnation as an analogy, we can say that the Bible is 100% the work of God and 100% the work of humans at the same time. This is known as the incarnational model. So God was at work in every part of the writing of the Bible, just as 2 Timothy 3:16 says. But he chose to do this through the active minds of humans. We could say that God was guiding the thoughts of the various authors, but they are still their thoughts, arising out of their worldview and expressed using their words. Well, what does this mean in practice? Essentially, it means that God lets his children tell the story. And this is what we find in the book of Joshua. It's a story detailing their interactions of God and his people, the Israelites. But it's told from their perspective. Yet, paradoxically, at the same time, God is still at work in the story. So in the book, we find a number of spiritual lessons that the Israelites learned, and many of these principles will still have relevance and can be applied to our lives today. My guess is that this is the interpretive approach that we'll be utilizing in this teaching series going forward. Now, while God is at work, revealing himself to his people through words and deeds, God allows the biblical writers to interpret what he reveals to them. And they do so from within their worldview and their cultural categories. In other words, the Bible bears witness to what God has done, but it does so in ancient and culturally diverse ways. And God is okay with that. Now, if I had more time, I'd love to show how this all works by discussing the cosmology that we find in the Old Testament. That is, what these ancient writers understood about the nature of the world, how they believed the earth was a flat disk, sitting on pillars over water, under the sky, which was a solid hemispherical dome that rested on a ring of mountains. And this view of the universe was common across the whole of the ancient Near East. Now, God doesn't care that this is their view of the universe, so long as they understand that He is the one who created it all. He doesn't bother to correct their misunderstandings. What is more important is the theology behind the cosmology. But their cosmology demonstrates that they are very definitely people of that specific time in history. Well, something similar is going on with the supposedly God-ordained genocide in Joshua. So here is a good quote from the evangelical scholar Peter Enns on the violence in Joshua. One also might wonder why holy war, which is a rather sanitizing way of putting it, was necessary at all to the God of creation. Was gaining a plot of land that important? Were the Canaanites really deserving of death more than anyone else in the ancient world? A far simpler and less problematic explanation is that these are stories that the ancient Israelites told, which reflects their genuine but ancient faith in God within the conceptual parameters of their historical context. In other words, the Israelites truly believed they were doing the right thing, but this is simply because they are people of their historical context. So in the book of Joshua, the Israelites are telling their own story with their own tribal biases and their own cultural assumptions. And we know from historical sources that the nations of this region were often calling for holy war, that is, the total destruction of all men, women, and children, against one another. So it's not at all surprising that this sort of language pops up in Joshua. What's interesting, though, is to compare the idealized portrayal of the capture of the land that we see in the book of Joshua compared with the less idealized portrayal that we find in the book of Judges, where Joshua talked about the total destruction of cities and peoples. Judges shows us the Israelites living in the midst of various Canaanite tribes. So it looks like they didn't actually achieve anything approaching genocide. Okay, so the Israelites believed God wanted them to wipe out the Canaanites. But what's God's role in all this? Well, I would argue that God did not command the genocide. But paradoxically, He was still at work in this grim situation. Because I think progressive revelation is still involved, that same concept. God was still trying to direct His people in a certain direction. So while the story of the fall of Jericho definitely involves genocide, it also involves a demonstration of grace and mercy to a prostitute and her family. This is God at work within the Israelites' worldview and cultural environment, but pointing towards His ultimate goal. Again, in the Pentateuch, we catch glimpses of God's gracious love. I had Exodus 34, 6 to 7 up before. It's a great example of this. But these glimpses of God's gracious love are filtered through the worldview and culture of the time, which was brutal and bloodthirsty and which sought divine blessing even for the slaughter of women and children. And yet God persisted. So even within the pages of the Old Testament, we see developments in thoughts and behaviors, always moving in a particular direction, always moving towards greater levels of justice and mercy, of compassion and love. And the ultimate destination God has in mind? Well, as before, the destination is Jesus, the perfect revelation of the nature of God, who, as John's Gospel tells us, was full of grace and truth. Before wrapping this up, I'd like to just take this one step further, because our theology shapes our view of God. So if we look at these three options regarding genocide in the book of Joshua, we need to stop and ask ourselves, what do these explanations each say about the nature of God? And then you might also be sitting there going, I didn't hear very much of a difference between options two and three. You know, they both involve this progressive revelation. But there is quite a significant difference. Well, I would argue that the first option leads to a view of God being all about law and judgment. Now, there's definitely some truth in that. God does take sin seriously. After all, he sent his son to deal with the problem of sin. But there's more to God than just judgment. The second option results in a God who changes as external culture changes. God is reactive. It's like he's on the back foot, responding with a moral update when the external situation has changed in some way. So in Joshua's day, genocide's fine. No problem. Moving on 1,000 years and it's not. So that's sort of what we get from the second option. But with the third option, we see that God is gracious in that he works with his people within their historical context and culture. But he still seeks to change them, directing them towards his moral ideals, as seen in the person of Jesus. So God is not reactive, but directive, always pointing towards Jesus. And that's why I hold to an incarnational model of Scripture, because the resulting view of God matches with what we see in Jesus. It's also why I think it is right that we find the supposedly divinely ordained violence in the book of Joshua disturbing, because genocide is truly terrible. At the time, the Israelites believed they had a God-given right to take over the land. However, we who live this side of the incarnation, who have seen the ultimate revelation of the nature of God in the person and work of Jesus, we recognize that they were very much products of their time in history. Because God always wanted people to live in peace with one another, upholding justice and mercy, thereby demonstrating the gracious love God has for all people, not just his chosen people, the Israelites. So, by facing the elephant in the room head on, we actually come to a better understanding of the nature of the Bible itself and a better understanding of the nature of God. All right, I've given you a lot. So take a few minutes now just to discuss this with the people next to you. And then in a sec, we'll have a time of prayer.